Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, China's quest for superpower status. For years, Americans have asked, will China surpass the U.S. in influence around the world? Now, as America fumbles the handling of the pandemic, the question has been raised, maybe the time is now. Journalist Michael Schumann says, not so fast. He claims America still reigns superior in many key economic areas. Schumann also says it's important to remember that China's desire for global power goes back centuries, and it's a history all of us in the U.S. should better understand. Schumann's new book is Superpower Interrupted, The Chinese History of the World. I spoke with him Monday from Hong Kong, hours before the Chinese government signed a new law giving Beijing sweeping new powers over Hong Kong. Michael, the idea that China will replace America as the world's superpower is something people have talked about over the years, but even more so during this pandemic. How do you see it?
A lot of the discussion about China in the U.S. sounds like people believe that it's just kind of a sure thing that one day China will be the global superpower, will be the world's largest economy, will take over for the U.S. There's reasons to think that when you look at Chinese history. I mean, what's remarkable about Chinese history is how often Chinese society has been able to rebuild the pillars of their power. I mean, for large stretches of time, China was a superpower. China was a very dominant political force in East Asia, was one of the world's largest economies, and was I think most importantly, a major civilizational influence. And when you think about East Asia, what is East Asia? It's really kind of a Chinese cultural zone, because Chinese culture and its arts, its literature, its governing institutions, its books were very, very influential through the whole region. But China wasn't always a superpower. It had periods when the emperors were not very weak, or there was no unified political entity in China at all. But again, eventually the Chinese were able to turn themselves back into a superpower. And when you look at what's going on today, in that sense, things look somewhat familiar, that after a period of weakness of a couple hundred years or so, you see the Chinese again trying to strive for that superpower status. And they're rebuilding the pillars of their power. They're back to being one of the world's largest economies. They're gaining in political and diplomatic influence around the world. So in some ways, when you see what's going on, it fits very, very well into thousands of years of Chinese history.
So is it more or less inevitable with everything that Americans use, or a good part of what Americans use, being made in China and their economy? Is it inevitable?
I think that a lot of Americans actually don't appreciate some of the amazing strengths that America still has. You know, there's been a certain strain of thought that America is in decline for quite a while. And of course, that's in a relative sense, because you do have countries like China and others who have been getting richer. Where the U.S. still kind of has strengths is, you know, the U.S. still manufactures a lot of stuff. The U.S. is still the second largest manufacturing economy in the world. And it makes things that are incredibly advanced, like, you know, like airplanes and chips and things like that, that aren't quite so easy to replicate. And, you know, again, I think going forward, what's going to be most important, and this has become a big part of the discourse on the U.S. and China, is technology. The U.S. is still clearly the technology leader. And I think when looking forward, I think that's really going to be the determining factor as to who's really number one in terms of, maybe not necessarily in size, but in terms of economic influence. You know, just because the U.S. may be losing ground in terms of size doesn't necessarily mean it's going to lose its influence in terms of its importance to the U.S. economy, to the rest of the world.
What about the government of China? Is that a plus or a minus as far as their continued growth in power?
That's a really interesting question because, you know, of course, the Chinese economic record of the last 40 years has been, you know, absolutely incredible. I mean, you're talking about a country that was one of the poorest nations in the world that is now the world's second largest economy that's more or less alleviated absolute poverty and has been able to go into, you know, developing artificial intelligence and building electric vehicles and all this stuff. It's an amazing, amazing story. But a lot of that story happened, in my opinion, because the state was withdrawing from the economy. You know, this was a communist society when the state was controlling more or less everything. The economic boom was generated when the state moved back and the country opened up again to trade, to foreign investment, to private business. The fear that a lot of economists have now is that in the last, you know, roughly five, six years or so, you've seen that trend reverse, where the government is playing a larger role in the economy again. State enterprises dominate a lot of the resources. The market reform seems to have stalled. So there's actually a lot of worry in the economics community that the current Chinese policy runs counter to what really worked here and may actually really not benefit them going forward.
What about the COVID virus and how China has handled it as opposed to how the U.S. has handled it? Has that somehow given China a push forward?
Well, the Chinese government certainly thinks so. They've been on a relentless propaganda campaign, making that very point over and over and over again. Look at how successful we have been compared to the U.S. And from there, they go to look at how successful our system, as in, you know, our more authoritarian system, has been compared to that American democratic stuff in actually solving this problem. And in that message, they're trying to make the case that that it's really China's time to be a global leader. It's hard to say whether this propaganda campaign is actually working. The Chinese in this process of this pandemic have done a pretty good job of alienating a lot of people as well. But the Chinese are certainly jumping on the problems that the United States is having right now and trying to capitalize it for their own benefit to promote their own power on the world stage versus the United States.
But how well is China dealing with the COVID virus?
That's a really good question, and it's really hard to answer. The Chinese, after they had their outbreak, the initial outbreak in Wuhan, where this whole thing started, they had some problems at the start. They suppressed doctors who had originally flagged this virus existed and could be a danger. And they did react quite slowly at first to the problem. Then when they really woke up to the severity of it, then they kind of kicked into high gear. And they put in very, very, very severe measures to try to control the virus. And they were able to stamp it out in a matter of a couple months. They still have an occasional outbreak, but they have managed to get it under control. However, it's not really clear whether we're getting the whole story from the Chinese. There are a lot of analysts who believe the Chinese have not totally shared with us the true extent of the outbreak here that they had, the true extent of the deaths. They may not know exactly what the severity of the problem was in the early stages. So yes, they've been successful. How much more successful compared to other countries is, I think, is still a matter for discussion and debate.
I know you've done a great deal of research for this book. Michael, I'm wondering from your perspective, do you buy the theory that was put forward by the Trump administration that the Chinese deliberately foisted this virus onto the world? Or do you accept that it came from the open food market or an accident in the laboratory?
I don't think this was a deliberate effort by China to create a pandemic in the world. I don't know what the purpose of that would be. You know, they've suffered greatly here as well. You know, you did have a lot of people die. You've had tremendous, tremendous economic damage. So the idea that they would somehow do this purposely for some reason, you know, kind of ignores the fact that they're as much a victim of the virus as anybody else. You know, you can get into issues of could the Chinese have done a better job of handling at the beginning, and maybe the world would not be in the situation that it's in if the Chinese had been more forthcoming about the problem at an early stage, if they had taken stronger action at a very early stage. Yeah, maybe the world would be in a different position than it is right now. At the same time, to kind of see it as done for some purpose, I don't really know why they would do that.
Tell me about the idea of soft power that Xi Jinping talks about a lot. What is soft power to the Chinese?
When you look back at Chinese history, soft power has been incredibly important to China as a superpower in the past, because even when China was not necessarily politically very strong or was militarily weak or was invaded by foreigners and all kinds of things, the attraction of their civilization was still survived all of that. And this created a bond between China and the rest of the region, where there were shared philosophical ideas, shared education, shared language in many ways. The educated of East Asia read the same books. They read Chinese books. This created a cultural bond between China and the rest of the region that sustained Chinese power for very long periods of time. And Xi Jinping understands Chinese history, and he knows that. And he talks a lot about bringing this type of soft power back. That's why, you know, the Chinese government promotes the study of Chinese language through Confucius Institutes, which is a Chinese government program that has institutes all over the world to promote Chinese language and culture. I would also say, though, that it's probably the pillar of power that the Chinese are having the most trouble rebuilding. That's because, you know, so much has changed in the last 200 years with the dominance of the West. And, you know, the societies in East Asia that used to be very tied to China, like Korea, Vietnam, are now not anymore with all the political and social and economic changes that have happened. And the Chinese themselves went through a period for about 100 to 150 years where they basically turned on their own culture, where they thought their own civilization was the reason why they were so weak, and they had to learn from, especially from the West, from the outside, to make their society a modern society again. So in many cases, China is just revisiting its civilization now again that had been so powerful for so long. So the government here realized that the importance of soft power, and that's why they're using, as we were talking about, the COVID outbreak and their supposed success with that outbreak as a way of promoting their own society and their own civilization. But that's an area where they still, I think, have a tremendous amount of work to do and a lot of challenges.
Michael, is there any discussion among Chinese government officials as to how the coronavirus is referred to by President Trump as the Wuhan virus or Kung Flu?
This has been a huge point of contention between the Chinese government and the United States. They have been on a relentless campaign to stamp out the use of the term, especially Wuhan virus or Chinese virus. They have tried to spread propaganda suggesting that the virus did not actually start in China. They want to try to, I think, create confusion as to the origin of this virus and create confusion about the role that China played in this pandemic and in causing the pandemic. So they've been highly sensitive to the name of the virus, which is why they have preferred to call it COVID and other things that don't necessarily attach the virus so directly to China or in the case of Wuhan virus, as a certain city in China. They're trying to disassociate themselves from the origins of this virus. I'm not sure the propaganda campaign can actually change what people know about history and what actually happened in the course of events, but they're definitely making a very strident effort at trying to squash the uses of that term.
Have you ever been to one of these open meat markets where some people say the virus originated?
I've been to these markets. You know, they're actually not really as interesting as people make them out to be. They're really just big, you know, fresh food markets. And, you know, where they become a problem from a public health standpoint, it's not so much the market itself, but it's when you have wildlife, certain animals that are eaten in the Chinese diet, that basically come from the wild, and they're brought into these markets where they're at close quarters with people, at close quarters with other animals. And I think that's where the public health issue comes in, not so much from the idea of the wet market itself, but from this kind of wildlife trade and the dangers that presents. I mean, the government now supposedly trying to get a handle on that and to clean that up. But, you know, this is also a problem going back all the way to the SARS virus, which also started in a similar fashion. So this obviously, these wet markets, because of these wildlife animals that probably shouldn't be there, that's the reason why they're a public health issue that has to be dealt with.
What are the wild creatures of which you speak?
You know, the animals that have created the public health problems. I mean, in this case with COVID, there's an assumption that the virus actually came from bats. So these are bats that are basically taken out of the wild and brought into markets for food. With the SARS case, it was something called the civet cat. And, you know, again, these are wild animals. So they're not actually really supposed to be in, from a public health standpoint, in this type of environment. The government claims that they are going to finally get a handle on this problem, something they probably should have done after the SARS outbreak, that now with this outbreak, they at least appear to be taking it more seriously.
More of my conversation with Michael Schumann when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Michael Schumann. He's a contributor to The Atlantic and columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. His new book is titled Superpower Interrupted, The Chinese History of the World. I want to take you back into China's history and how it may still have relevance today. You trace it back to 221 BC, and you say there was a turning point there. What happened?
221 BC is one of those really important years in history. That's when China was unified into kind of a centrally controlled empire. Before that, they were dynasties, but they were ruled rather in a decentralized fashion, not quite a feudal system in the way we understand it, but something along those lines. What happened in 221 BC is that a man that we call the first emperor, he was the one who was buried with the famous terracotta warriors in Xi'an. That's how he's best known. He was the king of a state called Qin, and he defeated the other states of China and created the Qin dynasty in 221 BC. And this was a unified state where power flowed from the center through a bureaucracy, through a structure of provinces. And what's amazing about this is that to a great degree, his handiwork is still around. I mean, the Roman Empire is gone, the Greek Empire is gone, all these empires have come and gone. Obviously, modern China is quite different than China was in 221 BC in all kinds of ways. But when you think about China, China is a unified, centrally controlled state in the same geographic general area where the Qin Dynasty was. So what the first emperor did in 221 BC, it basically still around with us today.
So how does the current leader, Xi Jinping, see himself fitting into that history?
That's a good question. He talks about Chinese history a lot. He quotes China's ancient philosophers very often. He's very knowledgeable about Chinese history. And he has tried to present the current government differently than his predecessors. Where I feel like he's tried to present this government as almost a successor state to these past dynasties. Not that it is like a dynasty, but that it's playing the same role that the old dynasties did. And he has this idea that he calls the Chinese dream. And when you read about the Chinese dream, it's this incredibly vague concept. But what it really is about the restoration of Chinese power on the world stage, the restoration of Chinese greatness. And that's really what he's about. That's what he's about. His message to his people is, we all want China to be great again. We want to make China great again. And I'm the guy who's going to do it for you. And in that way, he's connecting himself with all of these other, as we were talking about earlier, these restorations of Chinese power, with these other emperors who made China great and powerful again. So I think he sees himself and the current government as a part of that long epic history that China has had of being a great power for so long.
And he sees himself as perhaps something akin to an emperor?
I don't think he'd ever admit to that in public, but he's president of a communist state. But when you look at how this government operates, you know, how different is it from one of the old dynasties? Under Xi Jinping, power has been increasingly centralized in his hand. This is looking more and more like a one-person government. In the old dynasties, the emperor was the source of all authority. He governed with ministers and other people of influence, but he was the sole source of authority. And when you look at what's going on today, how different is today's government really, as Xi Jinping gains more and more authority? So whether he actually sees himself as an emperor per se, like the old emperors used to be, his government is certainly functioning a lot like one of the old imperial dynasties.
We're speaking with you from Hong Kong. Give us a sense of where things stand there in Beijing's effort to take back Hong Kong.
Well, you know, this is a very tense and controversial moment in Hong Kong, as the Beijing government is trying to impose a new national security law here, which will likely be used to squash out whatever remaining opposition there is here to communist rule. The government in Beijing has been striving towards eradicating the pro-democracy sentiment here in Hong Kong, which is extremely strong. They see Hong Kong as kind of an open wound of democracy, and they're otherwise what they consider to be an orderly society. And they're very, very intent on getting their grip on Hong Kong. And, you know, the city has been seeing protests now for a year as the people kind of stand up for their civil liberties and try to protect their society here. I think a lot of people see this national security law as like, this is really the final moment. This is really the last battle. If this national security law goes through and the Chinese are able to get the kind of control here that they're seeking, then a lot of the people here feel that Hong Kong will no longer be Hong Kong, the Hong Kong that they know, the Hong Kong that they grew up with. So it's a very, very serious moment right now in Hong Kong.
These two societies live so differently. How can China force that upon Hong Kong and bring those citizens who've enjoyed, I mean, let's face it, a kind of freedom that they would never have under authoritarian rule like that of China?
Well, from the perspective of the government in Beijing, you know, they don't see the value in these types of civil liberties and democratic sentiments. And Hong Kong was handed back to China in 1997 by Great Britain. It was a British colony for around 150 years. And for the Chinese government, this is the righting of an old wrong. They considered the cessation of Hong Kong to Great Britain after the first Opium War as, you know, one of the great humiliations of Chinese history. And that the return of Hong Kong to China is now setting that right. But of course, what that's ignoring is, as you pointed out, that, you know, all that time, Hong Kong was separated from China, and it has its own history. It has its own identity, it has its own institutions, its own schools, its own legal system. Yes, they're ethnic Chinese, and they do have some generally affinity towards China, but it's many ways it's a foreign society. And so what you're really seeing is the Beijing government imposing its system and its will onto a Hong Kong society that has very, very different values. This is not going to end well.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? You know, it's hard to tell at this point what could stop the Chinese government from moving in the direction that they are. I mean, they face widespread condemnation from the major powers around the world, and that doesn't seem to be influencing them a whole lot. They face massive protests on the ground. That's not influencing them a whole lot. Hong Kong is part of China. So even though it's been run as a separate administrative region, it is part of China. And so the Chinese feel that this is their territory and they can do as they feel they need to do. But will the people of Hong Kong or the majority of the people in Hong Kong be reconciled to this? Will they live in this environment? Will they put their children in schools that are run by this government? Unfortunately, for a lot of people, I think the answer is going to be no. This could mean that a lot of people who are Hong Kongers and consider themselves Hong Kongers may not be able to live in their home in the way that they otherwise would have. And you could see an exodus of people from Hong Kong. Or they'll have to live here without the liberties and the values that they kind of cherish. So either way, it's a sad situation for where the city is going, and it's bad for the city. I mean, this is Hong Kong is one of the great financial centers of the world. And, you know, why is that? Well, that's based a lot on the rule of law here, on the independent judiciary, on the free education system. So if that's gone, then you know, you can see Hong Kong and the place that Hong Kong has had in the world also going away. So it's kind of a tragic story right now.
I mean, do you see a confrontation the likes of Tiananmen Square coming?
Well, I would hope not. You know, the protests here have been getting increasingly violent. And there's been a lot of action by the police that are seen as being very brutal and unjust. You know, we haven't gotten to the stage, obviously, of Tiananmen, where you have thousands of people getting killed on the streets. Will it come to that? You know, you can see how the series of events could play itself out, where you could get to that point. That doesn't mean it will, and I hope it doesn't. But there are certain elements in Hong Kong that are very, very, very committed to their cause, very committed to democratic values, and very committed to protecting their home city. They may not give up so easily.
Now, after Tiananmen Square happened, what would you say is the mood of the Chinese people themselves living in China after their revolt failed?
You know, it's an interesting question. It's very hard to get a sense of what the Chinese people actually think. You know, you don't have polls, you don't have a free press, you don't have freedom of expression. you know, you'll see some poll data done by organizations that show that the Chinese people are very supportive of their government, that they're quite happy with their lives, are very positive on the future. That may be true at you know, on a certain level. But, you know, like any society, China is 1.4 billion people. They are not a monolith. There are different people who feel different ways. There are some people who support the current system because they benefited from it. And there are some people who do not like the current system at all. And especially since under Xi Jinping, the government is becoming more controlling. The surveillance state is becoming expanded. They're using technology to monitor what people are doing more and more. And there are elements of society that resent that and resist it. There is a reason why you see so many Chinese wanting to move to the United States, who buy homes in the U.S. or study in the U.S. and elsewhere. And it's a sign that a lot of people are not totally in love with their own society in the way that the government would like you to believe.
Do we have any idea of the rate of poverty in China as it currently stands?
The actual rate of poverty in terms of absolute poverty is quite low. The Chinese have done a tremendous job of lifting people out of destitution. That doesn't mean it's a rich society. I mean, you can still find parts of China, and especially in the rural areas, where, you know, people are still quite poor, and they don't have great service. They don't have good schools. They don't have great government services. They don't have access to the same opportunities. You have, you know, a lot of migrant workers who live quite nice lives. Some of them still struggle. They work for low wages in factories and other low paid jobs. And there is a tremendous income gap in China as well. So overall, people have done tremendously well in the last 30, 40 years. But generally, any economic measure you can find, just think of it, think of any measure, and they've done really well. But that you know, this is still, to a great degree, a developing society, a developing economy, where people are not nearly as rich and do not nearly have the living standard as to what, say, we're used to in the U.S. and Europe.
So if you had the opportunity to speak with American officials at the highest level, what would you say to them as to how best to deal with China and continue as the U.S. superpower of the world?
I think President Trump has done us a service in one way, which is he's seriously changed the entire dialogue about China, where I think it's now become more apparent throughout the American politics and to a great degree American society that China is a strategic threat to the U.S., that China wants to gain more and more power, and it wants to do so at the expense of the United States. I think where he's gone horribly wrong is, okay, what do you do about that? There are certain aspects of his policy that I think have been positive. For example, in limiting how American companies can sell certain technologies to China, I think that's positive. But overall, his strategy has been erratic, and I think more than that, unilateral. In the world that we live in, the United States simply does not have the power in and of itself to deal with China. The U.S. has to work within like we did during the Cold War, work within a network of friendly states, other democracies, and confront China as a group and try to contain Chinese influence that way. Otherwise, the Chinese are just going to basically play off the democracies against each other, which is exactly what they're doing right now. So the problem with the president is that he's proven completely incapable of working with anybody internationally, and has alienated a lot of our allies, and they just will not work with him. If we're going to contend with China, the U.S. has to lead an international effort to isolate China and to force China into changing some of its more egregious practices, either in its theft of intellectual property, its unfair trade practices, its human rights violations, the threatening way in which it treats its neighbors. The U.S. can do a lot on its own, but it can't do everything on its own. And the effort has to be consistent across issues. The Trump administration has been very focused on certain specific things like trade. It has to be much more widespread to focus on a range of different issues dealing with China, human rights, Hong Kong, as we talked about, China's territorial claims that create conflicts with its neighbors. There's a whole range of issues that the U.S. has to be very, very engaged on, and with its allies. That's the only way that we're going to kind of contain China at this stage.
Michael, before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
What I would hope in all of this, because China's in the headlines so much, and a lot of the discourse has been very negative. There seems to be a lot of anger towards China. Whatever happens, whatever we think of China, China is here to stay. They're the largest country in the world. They want to be a great power. They are committed to being a great power. They think they have the right to be a great power. That's not going away. The U.S. and Europe, the West, they have to wrap their minds around this and realize that this is the reality going forward. And because of that, we have to know a lot more than we do about China. I find, unfortunately, the discourse in the U.S. about China shows that people don't really understand the issues. They don't understand the history. They don't understand how the economy works. They don't understand the role that China plays in the world today, let alone historically. And I hope that people in the U.S. will make the effort to understand a lot more about what China is, what China wants, where China's going. You asked me, what do we do? How do we contend with a rising China? This is one of the steps that we have to take. We have to appreciate more about what the society wants, where it's going, where it's been, what their worldview is. And then we can make really smart decisions as to what our policy should be. What kind of relationship do we want with China? The U.S. doesn't really know that right now. There's no consensus on do we do this decoupling, which is separating ourselves off from China? Do we still find a way of engaging with China? How do we do that? We don't have answers to these questions. I think there has to be a greater effort in the U.S. to educate ourselves about China, to not be so kind of rhetorical about it, and based on that increased education and knowledge, to really figure out what we want our relationship with China to be going forward.
Michael, thank you so much. It was good to be with you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Michael Schumann. His new book is titled Superpower Interrupted, The Chinese History of the World. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you want me to cover during this very difficult time. Please do continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Bent Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Please stay safe. Take care of yourself and others. Wear a mask. I'm Diane Rehm.